Manila Chan. You are tuned in to Modus Operandi. U.S. President Joe Biden is facing a crisis along the southern border with Mexico as 2022 tops the record for the highest level of illegal border crossings in U.S. history. Many saying he's more concerned with foreign borders than his own. This week, we'll examine the international hypocrisy of America's border bias. All right, let's get into the MO. ...2022 was a record-breaking year along the U.S. border with Mexico, with migrants flooding into the U.S. by the thousands daily. Domestic outrage as Texas Governor Greg Abbott, angry with the Biden administration's handling of the influx, began busing migrants out of his state, several times even dropping them off directly at the doorstep of Vice President Kamala Harris, who was tasked with being the so-called border czar. Meanwhile, internationally, the U.S. government is being called out for its hypocrisy of picking and choosing when to respect the sovereignty of other countries and their borders when it comes to bringing war to foreign lands. Now, to discuss the domestic issues being faced by the Biden administration, specifically the issue of Title 42, the Trump-era so-called Remain in Mexico policy, is U.S. immigration attorney Susan Pai. Susan, thanks for joining us. First, Susan, can you explain for our international audience what exactly Title 42 is and why it's a topic of contention here in the U.S.?
So Title 42 is actually a public health measure that prevents migrants or actually anybody from entering the United States in order to prevent coronavirus infection and spread. It was set forth by the Department of Health, and recently the Department of Health has stated that Title 42 is no longer applicable in the current atmosphere of testing and treatment. And so a DC court actually declared Title 42 to keep migrants out of the United States and being expelled from our southern border illegal in November, but the Supreme Court of the United States has stopped that cease order of the DC District Court. So the Supreme Court has intervened and will later hear the case as to why Title 42 should end or not end. So Title 42 has been used to expel 2 million migrants since its inception. And so where international law and our own law says that people can present at a port of entry, which includes obviously the southern border, and make a claim of asylum and then be admitted to the United States while their asylum case is pending. So Title 42 actually removes the right for them to claim asylum at the border. And so there's no way for those people to get admitted to the United States. And like I said, they've thus far expelled 2 million migrants under Title 42. Now, some of those may be repeat crossers, and it's estimated about 30% are, but nonetheless, the number is about 2 million.
And without passing judgment on whether Title 42 is good or bad policy, can you tell us the impact it's had on the flow of migration into the U.S.?
So Title 42 definitely has worked to usurp the asylum claim process at the southern border because, as I said, they have expelled 2 million migrants from the border without hearing their asylum claim since Title 42 started in the United States. However, its impact on overall numbers is actually negligible. Those numbers have actually increased. So, for example, in 2020, we had 50,000 encounters at the southern border per month. In 2021 and 2022, that number has increased to 200 and 250,000 per month at the southern border. So as you can see, the impact of Title 42 has not been to slow down migration attempts at the southern border. Actually, those numbers have increased. The undocumented population in the United States has remained largely the same, between about 10.5 to a million people unauthorized in the United States since 2005. Before that, in the year 2000, it was 8.5 million unauthorized documents in the United States. So what people don't understand and what we often hear in the media is that these are illegal immigrants coming into the United States. That's not the case, because we have international law and also our own law, which allows people to make asylum claims at the border. Once they're let into the United States pending their asylum case, they are authorized and documented aliens. So the unauthorized or undocumented alien number has not increased in quite a while, but the number of authorized or documented individuals, you know, who are waiting on an asylum trial to occur, like in 5 years, 6 years, or 8 years after they first cross the border, that number is greatly increasing. So like I said, the number of such encounters in 2020 was about 50,000 per month. And now that number is about 250,000 per month. So that's about 4 to 5 times higher than it was in 2020. And so the impact is really felt with the number of immigration cases that are backlogged. So the backlog in cases is, let's see, we have currently a 2 million immigration case backlog for 600 immigration judges. And just to give you an example, about 700,000 asylum cases have been decided by immigration judges since the year 2000. In fiscal year 2023, which has just begun, the asylum case backlog for just this partial year alone is already 800,000. And then to give you another example, in 2012, the asylum case backlog was 100,000. And again, like I said, the case backlog now in immigration court is 2 million for about 600 judges. And that number is exponentially increasing as each month goes on.
Susan Pye, immigration attorney and immigration law expert, thank you so much for joining and explaining. Oh, coming up next, accusations that the U.S. and NATO invented new borders to create Kosovo, and why the U.S. has no moral authority on sovereignty. We'll discuss it when we return. Sit tight. The MO will be right back.
Take a fresh look around at life. Kaleidoscopic, isn't it? A shattered reality distorted by power. Tired vision with no real opinions. Pictures designed to simplify or confuse. Who really wants a better world? And is it just for the chosen few? Fractured images presented as fact. Can you see through their illusions? Going underground can.
The Russian state-controlled narrative.
Als Teil der Sanktionen gegen Russland gehen die westlichen Länder gegen russische Auslandssender vor.
Mais écoutez, monsieur, c'est pas à vous de décider de qui est journaliste ou pas dans ce pays. On est en France, quoi. C'est pas possible.
We will ban in the European Union the Kremlin's media machine. The state-owned Russia Today and Sputnik.
RT, Sputnik, even our video agency, roughly all banned on YouTube.
Et merci à vous tous pour votre fidélité et votre soutien.
In 1935, fascist Italy, led by dictator Benito Mussolini, decided to expand its colonial empire in Africa and take over Ethiopia. By that time, Ethiopia was the only fully independent state on the continent. Back in 1896, its inhabitants were able to defeat the Italian colonists and defend their independence. Since then, Rome craved for revenge for the humiliating defeat. In the morning of October 3, 1935, without any announcement, the fascists attacked Ethiopia and bombarded it most severely. Ethiopian armed forces fought courageously, but the brutality of the Italians knew no bounds. They used not only massive bombing attacks on civilians, but also chemical weapons, toxic gases. This changed the course of the war. As a result of the occupation of Ethiopia by the fascists, 760,000 people were killed. The capture of the African state was committed with Europe's tacit approval. Britain and France recognized the annexation, giving the green light to further fascist expansion in the world and paving the way for the outbreak of World War II.
Welcome back to The MO. I'm Manila Chan. The U.S. often criticizes other countries for warring with its neighbors, telling others to respect the neighbor's sovereign borders. But looking back at America's modern history, the secret war in Laos, the U.S.-led NATO carving up Serbia to create Kosovo, or most recently, the U.S. bombing and conflict in Syria, complete with American boots on the ground. Is the U.S. really then in a position to slam others who have valid border concerns? Daniel McAdams is the executive director of the Ron Paul Institute and spent years working in the Senate and the State Department. He's joining us now to examine the policy of hypocrisy. Daniel, thanks for being with us. So we know in the waning days of 2022, a federal judge ruled to keep Title 42, that Remain in Mexico policy, that it should stay in place. This Trump-era doctrine effectively used the COVID pandemic as the basis for enactment to help stem the flow of illegal migration here into the U.S. at the southern border. The Biden administration, for their part, have done very little one way or the other on Title 42 or immigration policy more broadly. But what Biden has done only recently, adding a clause to T-42 stating that anyone from Cuba, Haiti, or Nicaragua crossing illegally on the land border would be an automatic return. Biden also began erecting migrant camp facilities across southern Texas, where you are. How do you read this administration's stance on illegal migration?
It's been a difficult couple of years for them because they really haven't done very much on it. Of course, everything that Trump did is automatically bad. So, you know, obviously the Title 42 was not something they were interested until January, in fact. And that's when the Biden administration started to move on Title 42 and started to try to strengthen it and add additional countries as eligible to be deported upon illegal arrival to the U.S. The question of why they hadn't done anything, well, obviously they have some constituencies. The left wing of the party certainly is very much in favor of open immigration. They view it as good for voters, and it may very well be true that that's the case. So they have a lot of different special interests that they have to deal with. But they also have the views of the American people. Now, there was an Ipsos poll, I think back in August of this past year, that found that a large majority, well over 50% of Americans, view what's happening on the border as, quote, an invasion. And so you're seeing a real shift in people's views. And I think it was in the low to mid 40s of Democrat voters who agreed with it. It was an NPR Ipsos poll who agreed with the idea that this was an invasion. So you have a balancing of competing political views. And I think that might have had something to do with a shift that happened in January with the Biden administration on the polling. But you have, I think we had something like 2.4 million people in 2022 arrested for illegally crossing the border. That's a significant number of people, particularly when you add in those that were not arrested or were not caught, which is probably many times more of that. So you do see a massive influx. And I would just say one thing, Manila. The one sort of wrinkle in this whole thing now is that it takes on, in my view, a national security component, having people coming over and you don't know who they are or where they're coming from or what business they have here, because you have literally billions and billions of dollars in weapons that the United States and its NATO allies have sent to Ukraine with zero accounting. And we've already heard from Finland, we've already heard from some African countries that these weapons are starting to show up in these countries. So you're going to face an increasing danger in the open U.S. border of someone crossing over, God knows what, a rocket launcher, a tank, you know, who knows what. But more seriously, it is a real issue. So there really will be a need for national security reasons to get a handle on the border.
And Biden has been accused of being more concerned with foreign borders than America's own. What of that accusation that the U.S. government in general, no matter who's in the Oval Office, that they always seem more concerned with protecting democracy over there? And right now, over there in this case is Ukraine. Is Biden more concerned with Ukraine's borders than our own, you know, since the U.S. is dumping north of $100 billion into Ukraine?
Well, I would say yes. I mean, it is a border issue, and we have referred to it that way, that, you know, we're concerned with the borders of other countries more than our own. But of course, as we know, it's bigger than a border issue. It's a proxy war with Russia that the Biden administration is undertaking. And I would just, you know, look back, if you look at the Bush administration, it was the war on terror. And that was basically the premise was, if we invade Iraq, democracy will break out like a plague of goodness across the Middle East. Everyone will be happy and dancing in the streets. And then Obama came and said, we're going to remake the Middle East. And they invented the Arab Spring as a way to remake the Middle East. And of course, like all neocon plans to remake the world, they both ended in abject failure. And along comes Biden with a lot of Obama retreads. And he says, hold my beer. I'm going to have a regime change in Russia. You know, forget about this Middle East stuff. So I think that's exactly what we're seeing now. There hasn't been a lot of emphasis placed on the U.S. borders for a number of reasons. But certainly the borders of Ukraine are what was Ukraine, speaking of Crimea and the eastern provinces that are now legally part of Russia, according to Russian constitution. Those are a border issue. But again, I would say it's part of a larger U.S. and NATO regime change operation targeting Russia than anything else.
Now, permanent Washington, I like to call them that, the unelected bureaucrats, they seem to cherry pick when to respect or observe borders or the sovereignty of nations. Take the years of illegal U.S. bombing in Syria as one example. No war between Syria and the U.S. has been declared. Congress did not approve any war with Syria. How does permanent Washington then arrive at when to respect borders and when not to?
Well, there's a powerful lobby in Washington called the Military Industrial Complex, and it gets terrified when there's a prospect of peace breaking out. Of course, when we saw the end of the Cold War, there was a prospect of a peace dividend, and they began to ramp up the war on terror and other things. And of course, right after we got out of Afghanistan and there was the possibility of the U.S. stopping, flushing all of that money down the toilet that we spent for 20 years, well, that's when we started ginning up Ukraine. So the deep state, the permanent state in Washington, D.C., the lifeblood, the literal blood that runs through their veins is war money. And it makes everything flow in Washington, from the media to the think tanks to everything. So that is exactly what makes it flow. But, you know, with regard to the Middle East, you know, the U.S. has powerful allies and powerful forces there that have sucked the U.S. into wars that really have nothing to do with our own security. Our alliance with the Saudis, which is now going south, our alliance with the Israelis that seems to be going slightly south, of course, and our alliance with Turkey, all three of those signed on to regime change in Syria and were promised all sorts of goodies and things that they wanted because of it. And of course, again, as I say, as with all of these plans, it didn't work out. It works out terrible. It turns into a disaster. And even the Turks have finally realized this. At the end of last year and the beginning of this year, as your viewers no doubt know, there have been some high-level meetings between Turkish and Syrian leaders. We may even see a meeting between Assad and Erdogan coming this year. The Turks have apparently agreed to pull all of their forces out of Syria, and both Assad and Erdogan focusing on what they view as the Kurdish threat, the Kurds being America's only allies in Syria. So it leaves a very interesting dynamic there that's happening. But these are the special interests that pull us in. And then when things go south, they just move on to another to another conflict.
There's also the curious case of Kosovo. The U.S.-led NATO effectively decided to create a brand new country. They drew up brand new borders around the Clinton and early G.W. Bush era. Is it really that easy to just create new countries and new borders? I mean, what's that process supposed to actually look like?
What was that saying from the Bush official where he said, "We create realities"? You know, that's the mentality of the neocons. But, you know, the Yugoslavia project was an ongoing project, and certainly you saw it come to fruition under President Clinton, who was a pretty evil president and a pretty evil guy, and surrounded themselves with these evil people. But the idea was to break up Yugoslavia. That's what they wanted to do. That's why they ramped up nationalisms. They had to stick Croat against Serb, against Bosnian Muslim. And they did a pretty good job of doing that. And I think one of the reasons was, first, they wanted to break off Croatia, which was most eager to join a new Europe. And I think that was the first thing. And once that happened, I think the idea was to destabilize and overthrow and permanently defang any of the former Yugoslav territories that would historically be pro-Russian. I think the Cold War never ended for these people. The goal has always been to overthrow Moscow. And I think this had something to do with it, even if we had our own puppet in power at the time in the Kremlin. So that's why you see now a Serbia, which had suffered a coup in the year 2000, and the end of any kind of nationalism or pro-Russia sentiment. And what you have in Serbia now is very, very weak and controlled leadership, and it has been for the past, 25 or 30 years. And the same is true with Montenegro, which had been historically close to Serbia and to Russia. That has also gone, completely in the camp of the U.S. and NATO. I think we're seeing a shift, and this is something that really is not appropriate for our show, but we're seeing a shift in these alliances. But I think essentially that's what the case was. The idea was to break up Yugoslavia and the idea of picking up all the pieces and bringing them into the constellation of stars.
Yeah, excellent point about how the Cold War never really ended. Now, how would you compare Kosovo to Crimea? Now, in the latter, they actually held a referendum vote to secede from Ukraine and rejoin the Russian Federation, but the U.S. and the West did not accept that vote. Can you compare and contrast for us?
Well, as you well know, Manila, the only votes that count are the ones that go Washington's way. And I would add Brussels, too, because if you remember every major EU agreement where the countries have voted the wrong way, they've had to redo them. I think Poland was victim of that a couple of times, and Denmark, what have you. So, it only counts if you vote our way. And your viewers will probably remember, and I'm going to paraphrase the essence of what she said, but Hillary Clinton said when she was Secretary of State, sure, we need a vote in the Palestinian territories, but we need to find out how they're going to vote first. We need to find out who they're going to elect first. And that's the case in Kosovo and Crimea. There really isn't much of a comparison because, as you say, there was a referendum. And, there's the claim that this was a forced referendum, that people were forced with guns to their head to vote for Russia. None of the statistics, nothing that we know about Crimea would bear that out. And of course, if there was violence used, we would have seen it. There's no question about it. These are people that have been Russian or pro-Russian for the longest time. And we know how long Crimea was part of Russia. So it's kind of an apples and oranges in a way, other than the fact that there was a vote. In Kosovo, there wasn't a vote. There was a decision made by the U.S. and a few allies. But of course, the majority of countries in the world don't recognize Kosovo as an independent state.
Now, last, many would say the U.S. is in the business of destroying countries to then nation build in its own image. Is that a fair criticism or a fair judgment?
There's a dangerous totalitarian impulse in liberal globalist thinking right now, and you can trace it back quite a bit. A book that really influenced my thinking on this is Ryszard Legutko. He's a Polish intellectual who wrote a book called The Demon in Democracy, Totalitarian Temptations in Free Societies. And it's the idea that there is only one final way. We are at the end of history. You have to do it this globalist liberal way. This neoliberal world order is the only world order. We set the rules. The rules of international order are ours to set, and nothing else is acceptable. And that's a recipe for disaster. It's a recipe for war. And it's the recipe for the eventual war that happened between, of course, Ukraine and Russia. It's the essence of our fight with Iran, because Iran chooses to have a different kind of society than we have. So there's this totalitarian impulse among the U.S. And its followers in the West and NATO, that there is only one international rules-based order. We make the rules, we make the order, and if you don't follow it, regardless of your history, regardless of the evolution of your society, regardless of your religion or lack of religion, if you deviate, you will either submit or you will be invaded. And there are many intellectuals that have recognized this. Alexander Dugin in Russia, for example, has been very interesting in fleshing this out. But it's a dangerous impulse. I think it's doomed, like all totalitarian impulses. It's doomed to failure. But between point A and point Z, unfortunately, there's going to be a lot of bloodshed and misery.
All right, I actually lied. One more as a follow-up. Based on what you've just described for us, for as much as the U.S. likes to fashion itself as a beacon of democracy, it's starting to sound more like the U.S. is an empire. So is the U.S. a democracy? Is it a republic? Or is it an empire?
Well, we're an empire. Democracy in itself is not very good. It's, you know, it's two wolves and a sheep fighting over or voting on who's for dinner, as the saying goes. So in itself, it's not. But we don't even, we preach the gospel of democracy. And of course, everyone, the U.S. Neocons, the U.S. Washington foreign policy establishment endorses overseas, is the opposite of democracy. I mean, we're our great democratic ally in Ukraine, shut down all media that's not state media, closed down all political parties that not agree with him, shut down the church even. And this is our great democratic ally. Our wonderful allies in the Middle East include Al-Qaeda and in Israel with a very sketchy human rights record. Let's be honest about that. So we do tend to endorse and support the worst of the worst as long as they do our bidding in Washington. And what really is needed is a change, a radical change in foreign policy. That's why at the Ron Paul Institute, we support a non-interventionist foreign policy, because we simply aren't smart enough to pick or choose how other people should live. We don't have the knowledge, and it would be immoral to tell other people how to live in any case.
Daniel McAdams, I got to leave it right there. Thank you so much for that insight. All right, that is going to do it for this week's episode of Modus Operandi, the show that digs deep into foreign policy. I'm your host, Manila Chan. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you again next week to figure out the MO.